nearby at high speed. It was an unfortunate, unforgettable sound. It was nearly 100 pounds of Wilderland's mutton. Frightful, in her large form, had torn the poor animal as thoroughly as a rabbit. Dara flew her from the direction of the sun, and activated the enchantment that transformed her as she descended. By the time she lit on my wrist, she was the same bird I'd cast into the air. Dara quickly took her, gave her a treat, and hooded her, while the courtiers and the prince looked in astonishment at the ram. Its horns had done nothing to save it from the giant beak of the enchanted falcon. Some farmer somewhere was going to be very pissed off in the morning. It seems nature has been bested by magic, which is also off the case. That sheep is a lordly catch, I'd say, though I leave it up to his highness to judge. What trickery is this? Prince Tavard asked, a scowl on his face. No trick, highness, I shrugged, just a very talented falconer, and a very talented bird.
Magic,
the count accused, looking back and forth between the dead ram and my smug-looking apprentice. Just so. As I said, things are rarely what they seem with wizards. The unexpected abounds. The natural order, the fate of nations, even the will of the gods, can turn on a bit of magic, in the right place and at the right time. With magic and wizards there is always a bigger prize, an unexpected opponent, a subtle meaning wrapped in a gentle phrase, hidden in an obscure misdirection.
What do you mean by this, spellmonger? Demanded Prince Tavard angrily. You dare mock me.
I instruct you, my prince, I corrected respectfully. When dealing with wizard folk, and mage lords in particular, knowing what game you are playing and for what stakes is as important as winning. Now, will you concede my victory at the hunt? Of course I would consent to your highness declaring victory, and my entry forfeit, under the circumstances. That is your prerogative. But while your winnings would go to buy wine, mine will go to support the war orphans of Tudri, whose fathers died to preserve the kingdom. Which shall it be, gentlemen?
That didn't seem very wise, master, Dara reproved, as we rode back to the inn in our rented coach.
She had frightful hooded on her block, and was staring at me accusingly. I had no problem reading her expression.
It wasn't, on the surface, I agreed,
but there was little I could have done to win Tavard's favour. He'd already made up his mind that I was up to something, despite my pretense. He called me on it, with his pedantic display about the natural order, so I called him on it, in unmistakable terms. And no, it isn't usually wise to humiliate a prince in front of his courtiers, especially one who is also your direct overlord. But you have to admit, he's really an asshole.
I would hesitate to argue with the opinion of my learned master, she said diplomatically, in a way that reminded me of Rondal. I still don't see what that gained us.
It was a matter of diplomacy, I decided. He told me not to do something I denied wanting to do, then dared me to do it on the grounds that both me and those I supposedly wished to defend are naturally and divinely unworthy of such considerations.
And this was diplomatic? How?
She asked skeptically. I let him know that I wasn't intimidated by his heavy-handed, arrogant, and condescending attitude to either me or his other subjects, who aren't fortunate enough to be of noble birth, or wealthy enough to bribe their way across the frontier.
So now he knows that you plan to oppose him, or at least are willing to show him up in front of his toadies in a way that implies you plan to oppose him. I'm still trying to see the point. Forgive me for my inexperienced perspective, she said sarcastically.
You've been spending far too much time with Pentandra, I complained.
It wasn't precisely wise, but since he wasn't going to do what I wanted anyway, and we are going to cross lances, politically speaking, and he did make a point of summoning me across half a kingdom to dress me down, I felt it was important to establish my relative power. He might be king some day. I'm the spellmonger right now.
But he is Duke of Castal right now, she reminded me, and it's the Duke of Castal whose vassals are going to be standing in our way if we try to cross that border.
Actually, I said, the Duke of Castal is going to stand there and watch every single one of us cross the border,
and he and his vassals won't do a thing.
What kind of spell are you going to use?
She asked, curious. It's more complicated than that, I said, thinking through my plan. It involves more misdirection than actual magic. And it's still evolving, I said a little defensively.
I look forward to seeing its brilliant conclusion,
Dara said dryly.
Frankly, so do I
sighed. We met up with Brother Hotfoot and the boys back at the inn, where we had, coincidentally, a leg of mutton and early potatoes for supper. The monk had successfully concluded his business in the city and had a large bundle to show for his efforts. He seemed preternaturally smug about it, too. Tyndall had been successful, though his purchases would not be ready for days yet, which was fine. Rondol had been assigned to secure supplies on Gareth's behalf, and had spent the day prowling the markets and speaking with merchants. The harvest was beginning to come in upriver, and grain merchants were eager to procure early contracts.
"Are you sure this is going to work, Master?"
Tyndall asked, as we finished discussing the details over dinner.
"It seems a pretty flimsy pretext to go on. Do you really think the Prince is going to allow this?"
"The Prince may not," I agreed, "but the Duke of Castile will. He won't have a choice, by his own words and under the law. And if we are very careful and set things up just right, he'll do so to avoid civil war." Or at least he will think that's what he's doing.
Civil war with who?
Asked Rondal.
Master, as far as I can tell, there is no one around who has the resources or the initiative to go against the royal house who hasn't already done so.
It's not the royal house, I reminded him. That's key to my plan. And as for who? Well, I'm in the process of doing that. Perhaps my greatest feat so far.
And what would that be?
Tyndall asked, spearing another potato on his knife.
Conjuring a duchy out of thin air,
I answered. But first we have to get an army. That's the last stop we have to make before we head back to Alshar. Chapter 22 The Orphans of Varun. While we were gone to Wilderhall, the rest of my staff had gotten the new recruits relatively organized and mostly equipped. Gareth had added another few cauldrons and a small army of cooks to the operations at Talrion-Burin, and Taran had finished more supply rods. Summer was waning, and I was anxious to get on the road before the autumnal rains turned every track into a muddy mess. There were 8 troops now, with Troop 6 and 7 made into training troops. They were composed mostly of newcomers and older Kasari, experienced enough at teaching by now to help them along. While not every child had every bit of equipment, most had enough of the basics to keep up, sharing with their patrol mates where necessary. When the Pathfinders set out that morning, all 4,000 children were as prepared for the journey south as we could get them. For 2 days along the road south, we made good time, more than 20 miles a day. The Kasari kids taught their songs and chants to the new kids along the way. Everyone learned how to cooperate around mealtimes, pitching in to cook and clean, and at night those orphans who weren't too exhausted were constantly working on the new skills they were being taught. Kids who had been cursed as useless urchins in Tudri learned that they could make a pair of boots, or sew a cloak, or make a bow without an apprenticeship or a guild. When they realized they would be required to learn to read, like monks and clerks, it amazed them. It was impressive to watch each of the pensive, insecure orphans who joined our company struggle and then triumph with each new bit of learning. Interestingly enough, those most enthusiastic about teaching the Tudri orphans the ways of the Kasari were those Wilderlands orphans we'd picked up earlier in our journey. They acted as ambassadors to the newcomers, explaining the strange ways of the Kasari in a manner their fellows could understand. They seemed even more adamant than the Kasari children about the importance of the codes and laws, as well as ranks and organization. From orphans who had nothing but the rags on their backs, these children had become competent leaders in their own right. I was starting to feel hopeful about our chances of making this work when we ran into our greatest problem of all. On the 3rd day on the road, south from Tudri, I received a message from Tyndall in the Pathfinders. Our vanguard had run into a larger force, a much larger force, of more children. Not just children, but mostly children.
A mob of them, just as ragged as the Tudri kids, if not more so, awaited the leading troop north of Verone. Hundreds of children waited in a field near the west side of the road, as Tyndall's troop marched down the road toward the capital. As soon as they had seen the Kasari patrol banner, they had started cheering and enthusiastically swarming the confused marchers. It wasn't just a few hundred. It was thousands, as we discovered later that day, by the time I arrived with Troop 3. The field was covered with kids, war orphans like the Tudri children who had made their way all the way to Verone in the aftermath of the invasion. There they had survived on the outskirts of the corrupt capital on scraps, handouts, and garbage from the town. But once they heard about the march and its wondrous effects, they were possessed with excitement. A long, ragged trail of kids struggled to be the first to meet us and secure their place in the Spellmonger's magical march. Throngs of skinny children in ragged clothes came out to meet us in the fields outside the great refugee camps, and there were more arriving every moment. When I had arrived at Tudri and taken in 1,000 orphans there, the word had spread like magic to the vast fields of refugees at Verone. The rumors were just as outlandish as they'd been in Tudri, but the number of reports heralding of our arrival at Tudri had made believers out of enough, thousands, that no child wanted to be left behind from our marvelous march. The priests and nuns who had cared for them in the camps had tried to dissuade them from such foolishness, but the enthusiasm and reckless willingness to abandon security for the promise of something better was more powerful than wise counsel from priests. The adult refugees, too, had responded, with hundreds accompanying the children to see if the rumors of possible salvation were indeed true. They kept coming. As the Kasari marchers arrived up the road, so many of them recently in rags themselves, the thousands of Verone orphans cheered and screamed their excitement until I couldn't hear myself think, or hear anyone trying to speak to me mind to mind. It was hard, but we got our people encamped that night across the road from the orphans. The Kasari rangers did their best show of looking mean enough to dissuade any would-be thieves from stealing from our camp. The giant falcons and dogs both fascinated the children and validated every wild rumor they'd heard. The magical lights at the entranceways helped, too. Most of the urchins from the Verone camps were too awed to approach the things. "There are simply too many," Pentandra said, despairing, as she surveyed the thousands of children watching our camp on the other side of the road. 1,000 at Tudri was hard enough. Min, Festarden says that there are at least 6,000 here, now, and more arriving every hour. There's no way we can take them all. I know, I said, despairing. My ruse might have worked for a few extra Kasari, but for that many new children who were clearly not Kasari, they would not be allowed across the frontier, nor did we have any place for them to go. Yet there they were, miles from the miserable squalor they called home, on the faint promise of a better life. They came to see us because even a rumor of hope was better than the despair they faced daily. Like it or not, I was responsible for them being here. I was the great and powerful spellmonger after all. They had come for me. I felt like an ass. The chaos of the next few days made our time at Tudri seem like a formal occasion. Not only did we have all the problems we had with the Tudri orphans, we didn't have the resources and order provided by Astaral and the townsfolk. We were in an abandoned field, on the side of the road, 80 miles from the frontier. Our supplies were stretched thin, and there were thousands of extra mouths to feed, all of a sudden. Worse, some of the adults who had accompanied the army of children from Verone didn't have the compassionate intentions of the clergy who had come with them. There were incidents. I made some harsh judgments on the spot. Whether it's nature or the will of the gods who make the strong prey on the weak, when the stronger decide to levy justice, it's to preserve the best interests of all. Some people don't need to be around children. I made certain some never were again. Provisioning became a huge problem. The Kasari had food. The refugees didn't. I did the best I could to supplement, but it was just not going to work. Our careful and expensive procurement did not have that much surplus. We shared what we could, but most of the orphans on the south side of the road went hungry. Brother Hotfoot wanted us to stick with the original plan. Nothing had changed, he insisted. We just had to expand the scope of the original plan, by orders of magnitude. That might have been impossible had we not had the foresight and resources to include all the kids in it. After careful consideration and a lot of discussion, the monk persuaded me that it was worth trying. Our opposition had grown, too. The exodus of refugees from Varone was too grand to escape the notice of the spies that infested it. Soon, Dara's Skyriders and our war magi reported an increase in the number of troops at the checkpoint at the frontier, from 50 to 300. That was daunting, but if our plan worked, it wouldn't matter how many troops the Duke of Castal sent. A lot depended upon timing, and that was fouled up when the prince figured out how we were keeping our march supplied without a baggage train or supply depots. At breakfast the third morning in our encampment outside Varone, while we were still trying to sort out the orphans, something terrible happened. Or didn't happen. That is, when we summoned breakfast with the supply rods, nothing appeared.
"Oh, Ishi's temper," Rondal said,
realizing he was around a bunch of children when he repeated the command word to no avail. We tried each of the rods, but no kettles filled with grits or porridge or biscuits appeared.
"This isn't good."
Of course, we immediately tried to contact Gareth, mind to mind, but our manciple was busy evading arrest by the order of the Duke. I give Gareth a lot of credit. When the soldiers from the local castle came banging unexpectedly on my father's door, demanding that all operations cease, Gareth didn't panic. He sprung into action. While my mother and the cooks interfered in their search of the temporary kitchens, Gareth collected the magic rods and other essential supplies, used a few to grab what stores he could in their huckster pockets, and fled over the wall and down to the river. He hid out there awaiting a barge he could escape on, while the rest of our crew was instructed, by ducal decree, to stop all victualling and baking until further notice. Gareth finally contacted me near lunchtime, when some of our less courteous kids were grumbling. He informed me about the raid and his escape, but was unsure about what to do next.
"We've got to get you out of there, for one,"
I agreed. "My parents can take care of themselves, and I'll take care of them as well. But we have to rescue you. Where are you now?"
"A little village downriver called Grelin. There's not much more here than a dock, an inn and a stable."
"Get a room in the inn," I counseled. "Sit tight until I can come and get you."
"Why would the Duke raid a kitchen?" he complained.
"Because it was the only way he could stall me," I explained. "He's warned me against completing this quest, and I warned him that I wasn't going to let him stand in my way. So he found a way to complicate things without bloodshed. Commendable, really. If it wasn't so damn inconvenient." I wanted to panic. I couldn't afford to. I arranged with Astaroth for a few wagons of supplies to be brought from Tudri, but that wouldn't do more than keep everyone from starving, and it would take a few days to arrive. I also sent Dara's Skyriders aloft with instructions to hunt, the way Frightful had at Wilderhall. It was a stop-gap measure. A few deer or sheep or goats added to the pot would help, but I had thousands to feed. After a quick but intense consultation with my staff and with various members of the Order, I was able to get at least a trickle of supplies moving. I took a few hurried trips through the waypoints and picked up grain and salt pork from the Order in Castabriel, 20 bushels of potatoes from Sevendor, and a load of fresh milled oats from Robin Wing Castle. That was enough to keep the camps going, at short rations, for a few days. But I needed more. Much more. I needed a new space to prepare and cook from, to resume our magical supply. Someplace beyond Tavard's reach. Sevendor was too crowded to do the job, and too well watched. The moment I tried to recreate our lavish outdoor kitchens there, I would be caught. Similarly, using the Order complex in Castabriel was a poor choice. The prince would know about it before the first meal got served. I needed a big enough place that wouldn't be saturated with spies before it could even begin the task. I finally settled, at Astaral's suggestion, on the old encampment left over from the Battle of Timberwatch. The site was not too far from where we were, but safely out of the reach of the prince. Of course, the great army that had been there had long gone home,
but the earthworks, fortifications, and even the latrines from that great army were still present. A small garrison manned the Tower of Timberwatch, but most of its common folk had fled in the aftermath of the great battle. The basic facilities for storage and the kitchens we needed were still there. Wells, storehouses, and fire pits remained. I detailed Rondel and Ormar to go prepare them while I took Tyndall and Dara on a rescue mission. But first, we shopped. I took us down to the coastlands by the waypoints and found a good-sized river port whose markets I had yet to exploit. We bought more grain, far more than I thought we'd need, but we got it cheaper by the barge load. That gave me an idea, and soon I had an entire barge packed with our day's purchases. Next was the rescue. While my family shop was closed and under guard, they were still permitted to come and go as they pleased, as long as they didn't cook more food than the family could eat. They weren't hurting. I had paid Dad a premium price for his summer's labor, and he and his sprawling household were well provided for. But he was extremely irate over the arbitrary nature of the closure. Dad was a well-respected master of his craft. To his neighbors and peers, it appeared as if he'd done something wrong, and he hadn't. He'd spent the money to have a special protest sent to the Master Guildhall and filed a grievance with his baron. Since he wasn't allowed to bake, he took to haunting the taverns of Talry and buying drinks for any and all who would listen to the tale of how an honest tradesman was denied a lucrative contract because of the intervention of the nobility. He bought a lot of drinks. My parents, sisters, their husbands, and children were all fine, just really angry. They had poured themselves into the effort to feed the Kasari, and while the gold I'd paid more than made up for their lost trade, they still resented the closure. To be denied the chance to complete the task was galling to them. They had been baking more than 2,000 loaves a day, a staggering amount for a small village bakery. They had a sense of professional pride invested in the project. Bakers are like that. I told them to pack it in and lay low for a while. Their part in this adventure was over, and I couldn't risk putting them in more danger. I hadn't expected the prince to come at me that way, but I should have. Before I left, I snuck into the midst of the guarded compound the prince had confiscated and quietly used a hoxter pocket to steal back the cauldrons, cooking gear, and other supplies that were locked in the shed. Yes, they were under guard. When that guard woke up from his nap, the shed he was guarding still bore a large padlock. The fact that it was now empty escaped his attention. I hired a boat to make the quick trip downriver to the village in which Gareth was hiding and rescued him. He was looking worn and ragged from the unexpected pursuit. He had escaped with little other than his clothes, his witchstone, his mantle, and a bundle of sticks that proved to be the troop supply rods. I thanked him profusely for his service. And after a drink and a good meal at the inn, I transported us back to Sevendor. My manciple deserved a few hours of rest before we got back to work. I was tempted to rest myself, but I dismissed the notion. The panic I felt over the thousands of children who now depended upon me was driving me to push my limits. I could not fail. I had to use every means at my disposal, magical and mundane, to make this work. The alternative was too horrific to imagine. That didn't stop me. Travelling through the Alcan ways is tiring for a human. I'd been doing it an awful lot, and it was taking a toll. My body was exhausted from using that much power that frequently. My head was pounding like a drunken troll was banging on it, but I couldn't stop now. My burden had increased, and the stakes had never been higher. I transported back to the station we had set up in Timberwatch, the old blue barn we'd used as a magical corps headquarters during the battle. One of the Skyriders had taken a jaunt over there, due to its closeness to Verone, and deposited a waystone for me. That old familiar barn would be our storehouse. Outside, Tyndall and Rondel, with the help of some of the Hessians who volunteered, constructed 10 big fire pits for the cauldrons, and had the locals hauling wood by the wagon load to stock it. Unlike in the Riverlands, where fuel was at a premium, Timberwatch had an endless supply of wood. I conjured our stolen kettles from their pockets, along with the other cooking gear from Talry, and let them organize it while I found people to employ it. Finding cooks I could transport magically to the middle of nowhere proved more difficult than hauling a couple of kettles and some food to Timberwatch. Gareth was running a large operation in Talry,
and the number of mouths to feed had grown significantly. You needed a lot of people to prepare that much food that quickly. First, I drafted a score of Talalon from Hollyborough, in Sevendor, as scullions and assistants. It took 4 trips to bring them all through, but after they recovered from the trauma of transport, note to the historians, Talalon squeal miserably as they vomit. They scurried off to their duties. They had the great kettle set up on their fires before I was ready to leave to go recruiting again. This time, I needed human assistance. It took a lot of mind-to-mind communication to track him down, but thanks to the League of Mage Lords, who had come up from mercenary war magi and still maintained their contacts in that world, I finally located the man everyone agreed was the perfect candidate for such an emergency job. His name was Targad, and he was as famous in his field as I was in mine. He was so famous that he didn't have a nickname. Targad, a half-Emiran, half-Castoli army bastard, was legendary among the mercenaries for his ability to feed large numbers of men and make it look effortless. He had worked for 3 of the largest mercenary outfits in Ramir and Castal, including the Orphans Band, before taking the assignment of bossing the kitchens for the staging area for the Farisian campaign. I'd eaten his food as a recruit, and not even known it. He had gotten so good that he didn't work for anyone but himself anymore. He had formed his own mercenary company, specializing in victualling larger mercenary companies under contract. Targad's outfit included 12 specially built wagons, each designed as a component of a larger kitchen. He had assembled a crack crew of men as dedicated to his art as he was, and his company's service commanded a premium price. Had I the power and resources to do so, I would have hired them at the outset. But Targad's company, Death's Repast, was under a year-long contract to the Count of Jero in southern Ramir, more than 1,000 miles from where I needed them to be. And they were good mercenaries. They wouldn't blow a lucrative contract to an important client, no matter how much gold I stacked up in front of them. A mercenary outfit's reputation is everything. But I didn't need the whole company. I just needed their commander. Targad had a genius for cooking, organization, and improvisation that defied mere excellence. The story of how, during a skirmish with Ramir a decade ago, he contrived a 5-course meal for Duke Rad in an advance infantry camp with 30 minutes' notice, no special supplies, in the dark, and under enemy fire, was legendary. The Duke pronounced it an outstanding meal, and gave the man a golden-hilted dagger Targad wore to this day in appreciation of his talents. That was the kind of man I needed. Getting to his camp took 30 minutes I couldn't really afford, but the Alka Alon had few waypoints in southern Ramir, so I spent some quality time on horseback. That was a novelty, after walking so far over the summer, and it did little to stop the pounding in my head, but with magic's aid I made good time. I eventually found my way to Death's Repast's magnificent camp, and with a little bribery and a little rank, I was able to meet with Targad, just as his crew were finishing service for luncheon. For 8,000 infantry soldiers. I watched the process with fascination. Everyone in camp was fed within an hour, in orderly fashion, with an absolute minimum of fuss. Breakfast at Sevendor Castle during a shift change isn't that smooth. Targad was willing to speak to me, based on my rank, if not my reputation. The tall, swarthy man had long black hair, tied back under a blue kerchief, a long, well-stained cloth apron, embroidered with the grinning skull and plate device of the company. The famed golden dagger was sheathed at his belt. He did not seem to be a patient man. I introduced myself and explained I wanted to hire him. He told me his company was already contracted. I specified that I wanted to hire him, not his company, for a lucrative short-term assignment. He was skeptical. I was insistent. He was dismissive. I was persuasive. He began to refuse. I produced a purse with 50 coins from thin air that fell to the cutting board in front of him with an unmistakable clink of gold. I had Targad's interest. It took some quick and vicious negotiation about the price, once he heard the parameters of the mission. Nor was it a straightforward bargain. He knew about my capabilities. Indeed, he had acquired, at great price, some of the gear I'd enchanted for the orphans during the Timberwatch campaign, and included it in his inventory. He wanted a premium price in gold for his time, but he also wanted some very specialized custom enchantments, the kind only the spellmonger could create. I was both flattered and irritated, but I could appreciate his position and his intelligence. I would have done the same thing if I was in his position and possessed the leverage he did. That was just smart business. Hells, that was more or less what I'd done to Brigger. I started to appreciate her attitude more. In truth, I didn't mind doing the work he requested, purely for the exercise in enchantment, a field in which I was growing increasingly adept. In the end, we came to an accord, and he agreed to be ready to depart with his two chosen assistants the next morning. I gave him a waystone to make the journey easier. I liked Southern Rhaemir, I discovered, a land of gentle hills and pretty olive trees, but I couldn't spare the time to appreciate it properly. That's the problem with life as a spellmonger. Life has a way of passing you by while you're busy doing other things, until life decides it has had enough of your inattention and smacks you around a bit, which is why I collapsed almost immediately after arriving back home. Chapter 23 The Crystal Snowflake. When I went back to Sevendor, for some reason my materialization hit me a lot more forcefully than I had expected when I appeared in my workshop. My head throbbed, my mouth tasted of bile, my stomach was rebelling, and my body was trembling. I was weak. I called for my maid and quietly collapsed into a chair after one big glass of wine. I had a headache the size of my castle. When I tried to rise, my knees gave out. My face broke out into a powerful sweat. I swayed and swooned, and if it hadn't been for my valet, I would have hit the rushes on the floor. That alarmed everyone, and before I knew it I was surrounded by nearly every woman in the castle fussing over me. Sister Bemia appeared with her satchel of herbs and a disturbed expression on her face. She felt my head, tasted my sweat, listened to my heart and took my pulse in my feet, hands and neck. Her expression became a little grimmer. She dug around for herbs in her bag while insisting I be taken to bed immediately.
"You can't keep going at this pace, Min," Alia said insistently as she tucked me into bed.
Sister Bemia was just leaving, after leaving a steaming cup of noxious herbs for me to drink when it was cool enough.
"You've been on the trail for weeks now, sleeping outside every night, and all of this waypoint travel is... it's draining you," she said, concerned.
"I know," I admitted, much to my surprise. I had planned on dismissing her worries, but I realized that I had a few of my own. I'd never had a headache like this before. Using the waypoints took a fair amount of power, which was tiring enough, but the process itself took a toll on my body beyond simple arcane exhaustion. "I don't know how much longer I can keep this up. Have the Alcaalon returned from their conferences?"
"No,"
she sighed.
"Lesgathael is near deserted. Only a caretaker or two."
"This isn't their problem anyway," I sighed. "I have to get back to Southern Rhaemir and pick up the cook and take him to Timberwatch. This is my problem." My temples were throbbing, and my stomach was rising in rebellion against me. I didn't want to move, but I had to. There was too much to do, and only one of me to do it. I hauled myself to my feet, and collapsed on the floor, vomiting. The pain in my head surged until I couldn't see anything but red. Alia was alarmed and screamed for Sister Bemia, who was still nearby. Soon my valet and the women helped me to the bed in the tower, closer than the new hall. I collapsed on the mattress, feeling awful. I was covered in sweat, and I felt my whole body suddenly burning up with fever.
"I've got to go,"
I insisted weakly, as they covered me with blankets. I was sweating profusely.
"I've got to get back,"
I moaned. The room suddenly felt as cold as ice, as my tunic was soaked with sweat.
"It won't be your problem if you're dead,"
Bemia declared, with anxious worry. "You're physically exhausted. You're no use to anyone if you can't move.
You're to sleep until you wake on your own, and leave only when your head no longer pains you."
"Priestess orders,"
my wife insisted angrily.
"But the camp in Alsha," I protested, "the kitchen at Timberwatch."
"Will not fall into the abyss without you for a few hours,"
Alia interrupted sternly.
You have spent the last 6 months putting together the best staff you could manage. Let them do some of the work for a change.
I yield to my wife's superior wisdom, I sighed, sinking back into the security of my own bed as she brought the tisane in the cup to my lips. It wasn't as vile as I'd expected. It was vile in an entirely unexpected way, alkaline and sour at the same time. By the third swallow I felt my limbs grow heavy. By the fifth, my eyelids were closing. Alia kissed my lips as I fell asleep, and her kiss lingered warm there, a reminder of safety and refuge in the midst of my pain. I slipped into unconsciousness. My dreams were as frantic as my waking life, if not made worse by my own fears and imaginings. Images of the Kasari being torn to shreds by a surprise goblin attack, the refugees being corralled by the Gavani and treacherous humans into a vast slave coffle headed to the sacrificial stones of the Umbra. Seeing my apprentices dying from a betrayal I could not prevent, assassins and foes lurked in the dark shadows of my subconscious. My family was endangered by perils both known and unseen. In dream after dream I was given a hopeless situation and watched myself fall to defeat, the lives of those most precious to me forfeit for my failure. It wasn't all horror. There were moments, mere flashes, where I found some reprieve from my own mind. But they were tantalizingly few, and only increased my anxieties. But mostly it was one endless stream of catastrophic defeat and personal failure. I seemed to visit every corner of every personal fear I had. I'm grateful I don't remember all the details. When all seemed lost and dark, an unfathomable amount of time later, I remember being in a murky, misty forest in the middle of winter. It was as bleak and disturbing a wood as I'd ever seen, made worse by my own poor state. But along the thin trail I found a familiar if unexpected face, Brother Hotfoot. I'd encountered plenty of other folk of my acquaintance in my dreamscape, usually just before I did something tragic that led to their death, or worse. I wondered idly how my mind would conspire to do in the kindly monk. Hotfoot was sitting next to a small but cozy fire, a battered kettle sitting in the coals. "About time you wandered here," he said welcomingly. "I was wondering if you'd forgotten about me. Sorry. I've been damning more important people in my life with my mistakes," I grumbled. "Consider yourself fortunate. No doubt you're about to be eaten by a dragon while I sit here helplessly." "Such are the fortunes of the road," he shrugged. "For now, enjoy the fire, drink some tea and rest yourself. You're safe for the moment."
"I'm never safe," I sighed. "There are too many I care about to ever be safe. And now I've invested that care in thousands of kids who believe in me. This is beyond magic's power," I said, realizing the futility of the task ahead.
"Of course you're not safe. In general," the monk said, pouring the tea into a leather traveler's mug. "Security is an illusion. For anyone, even the gods. Few realize how tenuous our grip is on this world. But you can put aside your worries for a moment around the fire. A good fire is so very important."
"That's what my patron goddess thinks," I chuckled. "That's someone else I'm going to disappoint. It's just not wise to disappoint a goddess of vengeance."
"Your self-criticism does you little favor," the monk said, shaking his head and handing me the mug. "Minilan, this trick is not all on you. You began it, you lead it. You envisioned it, but it has a life of its own now. You have chosen good folk and given them resources. Even without you, they will accomplish much. Without me, they'll be slaughtered, enslaved, or die of disease and starvation in the wild," I protested. "You give yourself too much credit, and your people too little," the monk corrected as he stirred the fire. "You've set mighty things in motion with your magic and your ingenuity. Like a river from the mountains of the wilderlands, you have created a current of magic and fate that cannot be stopped by swords or sovereigns. The gods themselves are involved," he reminded me, "and once those powers have been invoked, they are not lightly dismissed or denied." "How many innocents have perished when the gods have been involved?" I reminded him. "Depends on the gods," he countered,
breaking off a piece of journey bread and handing it to me. It was chewy and a little dry, but it was filling and wholesome.
It's not like you sacrificed a village to Duin the Destroyer, you know. You set out with a particular goal in mind, and the divine current will follow that direction. You've encountered obstacles along that road. You've overcome them or found a way around. Where you have led, you have created a trail for others to follow, even once you have left the trail. Every step you've taken bears testament to your commitment to the task. The people who have joined with you in its execution have done so because of their devotion to you and your vision.
So much more to disappoint them with my failure, I said, resisting his attempts to cheer me.
Or challenge them with your devotion, he countered sharply. When someone who has done such great tasks falls short, do you think those around him are going to slink away in defeat, or will they be inspired to rise to the challenge of your vision?
They'll kill themselves trying to get it done, I conceded, but it's not their task to do. It's mine.
That's bullshit, Min, the monk chuckled. You can't delegate authority so adeptly without also delegating responsibility. Yes, it's your task. But you've ensured that it isn't yours alone. It's bigger than you now. Big enough to survive without you,
he said ominously. What do you mean? I asked, suddenly concerned. I mean that the choice to return to it or not is yours. You can elect to push forward, accepting the consequences of what you've created, whatever they might be, he said, nodding to one direction along the trail.
Or you can walk away and let things happen without you,
he said, turning his tonsured head and nodding toward the other direction.
It's your choice, Min. It's always your choice, he emphasized.
It's my choices that have gotten me here in the first place, I sighed.
Everyone has to be somewhere on the road, he shrugged, and where we are is always the result of the steps we've chosen to take. You can stay here in safety as long as you like, but eventually you're going to have to stand up and pick a direction and start walking. Eventually you're going to have to choose.
I did stay there a while. How long, I could not say, considering that it was a dream and my concept of time was skewed. I remembered the reluctance to leave the fire, to leave the security of the hospitable monk, and brave either path. I debated openly with him the advantages of both, and their perils. But eventually I stood, brushed the dirt off of my ass, and took my leave of the image of Brother Hotfoot. I walked back toward my responsibilities with the priest's blessing in my ears. I don't know how long I wandered. There's no sense of time in a dreamscape, at least not like this. I just kept putting my feet down, one in front of the other, just like I did when my bone-weary feet protested one more step on the march. I wondered idly whether or not this was actually playing out in the other world, or if this dismal adventure was confined to my own skull. Only a thaumaturge would be quirky enough to consider such a thing. The path I was on, the one toward my responsibilities, if you had any doubt, was broken and rocky. I'm certain it was an apt metaphor for something, but my aching feet didn't seem to be interested. It seemed as if I had been walking forever along this wooded trail, at night, in the daytime, under the blazing noonday sun, through all sorts of terrain, and sometimes all within moments of each other. As metaphorical journeys go, it was pretty interesting, and not a little frustrating. Eventually I came to a crossroads, and to the north there was a little clearing in the imaginary forest, where there was a point of interest. It was twilight again, and the little meadow was dominated by a massive stone forge. A blazing fire crackled energetically within. Brigger's cross was heavily gravened on the stone in a simple but elegant design. Brigger herself stepped from behind the impressive altar and studied me, worried. I was wondering when you'd show up, I nodded. I gave up praying to you for assistance or salvation 8 or 9 horrific failures ago.
I've been working on it, she informed me. You're very hard to reach right now. and there happen to be a lot of prayers directed at me at the moment, many of which concern you.
I'm touched, I chuckled.
Certainly not Abbess Parsley.
Don't dismiss the earnest desires of your admirers, the goddess warned. Even old Parsley respects you for all of her gruff manner.
My priestesses among the Kasari have organized ritual vigils across the camps to pray for your safe recovery. In Sevendor Town, folk have gathered around the Everfire to add their prayers for your health. Your family has beseeched all the gods willing to listen to bring you back to them.
I got the bloody message.
That's humbling, I admitted. Makes me feel a little guilty about loafing like this when there is work to be done.
Your life is at stake, Minalan, she said quietly,
the light from the fire illuminating her face in dancing shadows and making her brilliant red hair sparkle. Or maybe that's just what I wanted to see.
Yet you have made the decision to fight for yourself. That's an important first step.
Well, I did consider giving up, I sighed, warming my hands by the forge. But honestly, I kept thinking of all those 10-year-old Kasari kids, trudging along when they were exhausted, doing their best. If they can keep going and doing their best, then so should I. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
If your will is intact, then leading you out of your illness will be easier, she said sagely, and so very much still depends upon you, not merely the Kasari. You are destined for much more, if you live.
I can't help but feel troubled by your uncertainty on that matter, I said carefully. I thought the gods had a fair amount of knowledge about it.
The realm of the divine is far less orderly than you mortals believe, she sighed.
Your desires and will give us form and function, but the structures you have imagined for us are your own creations, she explained.
Thanks to you, the continuity I enjoy gives me the power of perspective and experience, and that has allowed me far more foresight in my actions than I have been able to employ in the past. That, Minalan, has the potential to change everything.
I just cast a spell, I said a little defensively. I wasn't trying to reorder the universe.
Every spell you cast reorders the universe, she pointed out,
which was a first-year thaumaturgical axiom that every apprentice knows.
That one was just a larger log in the fire than most.
So what is this grand destiny you speak so vaguely of?
Is not the reordering of the divine world enough? She snorted. Minalan, the gods have power, but we've been weak and unorganized, thanks to the limitations of our nature.
That's just where certain other powers wanted us to be, in order to keep humanity manageable.
Now, you and Snowstone have permanently altered the balance of power, real power, not the stuff King Rad thinks he's playing with, she added derisively. Your dalliance with the grain of pores has exposed you to a whole new dimension of magic. Your experiments with the pocket stones will eventually grant you incredible power. Once you work out how to transfer the enneagrammatic matrix through the portal spell without stripping it of vital energy. And you've just begun to explore what can be done with the other stones.
Yes, I do have a lot of work to do, I realized.
Important work, she emphasized.
I'm not here just for a pep talk, Minalan. It's rare that anyone, even a seasoned theurge, has access to these parts of their mind, permitting such direct contact with the divine.
But I talk to you, I pointed out. We're not just talking, she countered.
That's just how your mind is manifesting the experience. As a side effect of the injuries you've sustained, you've accessed realms of your subconscious that are usually enshadowed. I'm able to give you as much divine inspiration as you can handle.
That's likely not a lot right now, I warned. I'm just looking for a little guidance.
Guidance? Minalan, you don't understand. The unexpected introduction of Snowstone and all the other wonders that have arisen has dramatically altered even our ability to predict events, much less foresee them. The future lies in your hands, and even the gods await your visions before we can proceed. Rarely has a mortal held such sway over humanity's fate.
So, the gods are waiting on me, I guffawed. If that isn't the biggest cosmic joke. I'm just trying to get a few good things done. I didn't enlist to give orders to the gods.
We aren't waiting for orders,
she clarified, testily. We are waiting for your vision to manifest. That, at least, we know. Then we can react. But we have little idea what will come out of that feverish mind of yours, so we wait.
Well, while you're waiting, can you at least give me a hint? I asked, frustrated. Gods aren't supposed to be that passive.
I have,
she stated flatly, gesturing to the forge.
This altar represents the fever that is roaring through your body and brain right now.
A pretty, if destructive, metaphor, I agreed.
It's a forge, she pointed out, the symbol for creation, the altar on which a man who understands the mysteries of fire can bring forth from his imagination any shape and beat it into existence with the skill of his hand and the sweat of his brow.
So, my fever is supposed to create something?
Your fever is creating a lot of things,
she said obscurely.
But from it will emerge the vision you need to create what you will inevitably create.
Shouldn't it be an oven? I pointed out. My dad was a baker.
The flame creates, she replied. Its very existence is a function of time and situation. Fire is an event, unlike water, earth, or air. Fire is inherently transformative, from its ability to light the night, to heat the cold, to consume and destroy, or to create and enlighten. Every man and woman has a metaphorical flame within. Yours blazes now. Will you allow it to consume you? Or will you tame its fierceness and master its mysteries to allow your vision to emerge from its ashes?
You really didn't answer my question.
You need to build something, not bake something,
she said, rolling her eyes in exasperation.
All right. This is the metaphor your mind needed to manifest. I'm just working with it.
All right, I said, backing off a little. No need to invoke the whole consume and destroy thing prematurely. I understand. I need to forge something.
Build something,
she corrected. Likely a lot of things. No human mage has ever had access to the kinds of resources you enjoy. Not even the Arch-Magi at the peak of their powers. With the treasury you have, and that you can accrue, what mighty works could you create? What spells of power could you fashion? What could you do to change the world?
All sorts of things, I snorted back. Sure, I can make magic cauldrons of grits appear, but someone still has to buy and cook the grits. I can dabble in Alkan magic and Karshak song spells, and cobbled together some intriguing creations. But how does that help anyone?
I don't know, Minilin, she said, her eyes narrowing. What do you think would help anyone?
How about if the gods could actually do what we want them to be doing? I observed. That would be helpful. And while you're at it, eliminating the existential threat to the human race that keeps invading us might be helpful. We once ruled the skies in ways the Alon never did. Now we trudge down shit-covered roads and try not to get eaten by goblins.
Maybe dealing with that would be helpful. So, what are you going to do about it?
Brigga prompted, folding her arms across her chest.
Me? Why do I have to do anything about it?
You don't,
she pointed out.
That's the beauty of free will. But if you could, and let's just pretend that you could for a moment. What do you think the answer to those problems would be?
Well, getting the gods all on our side would be a start, I grumbled. The dead god is a fearsome foe, and if Korbal is ever found...
Korbal has been found,
she interrupted, her eyes downcast.
Sadly.
What? How do you know? I demanded.
I am not omniscient, she admitted, but I am rather well informed. Korbal's tomb was discovered, and even now there are those who toiled to revive him and his followers from their ancient slumber.
Gosh, that's just great news, I exploded with angry sarcasm. What are we supposed to do now?
Sherul was bad enough, more than bad enough. Now we have a 1,000-year-old Alka-Alon madman to consider?
He's far beyond mere madness, Brigger said worriedly. He is as dangerous in his way as Sherul is, perhaps more. But he is far more calculating and cautious than Sherul, and his enmity is not focused primarily on humanity, thankfully. But he will not hesitate in eliminating you if it is in his interests.
And how are we supposed to fight him?
Were the gods pulling evil dark lords out of their pockets just to toy with me now?
It will take time for him to regain his former powers. Once he does, he will be extremely difficult to defeat. You don't even want to know how many Alka-Alon died trying to control him the first time. If he and Sherul align...
So you have no idea, I sighed, feeling defeated.
I don't provide the ideas,
she suggested unhelpfully.
I provide the inspiration. You provide the ideas. That's how this works.
That's frustrating.
That's the nature of the divine,
she shrugged. If you don't like it, fix it.
That's kind of what this is all about.
At least you've narrowed it down, I considered. And I am supposed to build something.
A lot of things, actually,
Brigger said, sitting down on the ground in front of the forge, smoothing her long skirt as she did so.
As I said, you have resources undreamt of by Arch-Magi, or even the gods themselves. So, what spells can you imagine?
I didn't say anything. I joined her on the ground, in the heat of the flames, while the stars started to come out overhead. They were strange stars. The moon wasn't right either. Too large and too white. I found it disconcerting, so I stared at the fire. The flames were soothing. Brigger was right. Fire is transformative, and not just about turning wood into ash and heat. It had been so since the first time I accidentally lit the oven fires with magic. Before that, actually. Without the flame, the bread didn't get baked. Fire was essential to transformation. My eyes sank into the quivering coals, the pulsing plasma within the innermost recesses of the flame. I allowed my conscious mind to fade away, which was pretty ironic for a fevered dream. But there was peace within the coals and cinders, peace and transformation. As I let my thoughts drift in reflection to the flame, an inkling of an idea sparked there, and then another, and then another. The flame seemed to inspire me to consider problems from different directions and perspectives. Sometimes the answers were there, clear and obvious. Sometimes they were painfully elusive, or led to even more intriguing questions. My experience with the Grain of Pause had been instructive. I understood more about the enneagrammatic magic that underlies so much in everything, from basic elemental work to the dark science of necromancy, than I ever had. That was a part of it, I knew. Irionite was key, of course, but I would need more. The unique stones and crystals from my mountain were also essential, I realized. I wasn't certain precisely how, but between all the crazy enchantments we'd been able to figure out, it was clear that I would need several of them. And there were more under the mountain, I knew, somehow. Stones with yet more strange powers. No, this would not be a simple process, I realized. But once I realized it was a process, toward a specific goal, I knew I had the beginnings of an idea. I let my mind languidly drift from one component to the other, considering each separately, and then in relation to each other. No, the witch sphere was not going to be adequate for this purpose, which was fine. I always hated that name anyway. What it became was something far more potent in my mind. A mixture of imperial magic, Alka-Alon song spells, Karshak stone singing, and elements of the arcane that were strange and unknown to me. Yet the imagined result was far more potent than the sum of its parts. But was it as potent as a goblin head encased in pure Irionite? I could see that it might be. But even that wasn't enough, I realized. The power implicit in the artifact was great, but it was not sufficient on its own. To compete with the dead god, I finally understood. I had to overmatch him in resources, and Irionite was just one of his resources. I'm going to need help, I finally said,
after a few minutes or a few hours of gazing into the flames.
"Of course you are,"
Brigger said soothingly. "There is much you do not know, but you have managed to place yourself in a position where the people you need will find you," she predicted.